esteemed justices. My name is W. Michael Lewis of Lewis and Lewis Patel, LLC.
Hold on, please. People are coming in the courtroom.
Oh.
You may proceed.
My apology. My name is W. Michael Lewis, Lewis and Lewis Patel, LLC, out of Charlottesville. I represent Judy Massetti in this case, and I would ask for 2 minutes for my rebuttal.
Two.
Yes, mm-hmm. Your Honor. This is a case of legal malpractice committed by Chester during representation of my client, Massetti, during a criminal engagement. The trial court in this cause erroneously granted Chester's demur to DeSetti's complaint, and from that demur we have appealed to this court. Review, of course, is de novo. That also means that the entirety of the facts before this court are found in my client's complaint, which is JA 1 through 6.
Let me ask you about your complaint as long as we've got there.
Yes, sir.
I take it you're probably familiar with our recent opinion on Shevlin Smith that had to do with.
I am indeed. It didn't come down quite in time for me to address it in the brief.
I understand that.
But I'm familiar.
But in that case, one of the things we did was we said that non-pecuniary damages are not allowable. So now looking at your paragraph 34, what damages are you claiming compensation for at this time?
The damages I claim compensation for at this time would be she was prevented from working and will be so prevented in the future. The complaint also alleges that she lost her nursing license
right.
as a result of this. So it would be the non-pecuniary, her economic damages. She lost her nursing license as a result of this. She was prevented from working certainly for 6 months and perhaps into the future because of this.
Now, the 6 months was because of the jail sentence.
She was actively incarcerated for 6 months, Your Honor, yes.
Well, let me ask you about that. The original plea offer to reduce a felony to misdemeanor, was there any recommendation of 6 months? Or 10 days on that one?
That is not part of the record before court.
Mandatory sentence, isn't it?
No, if it was reduced to a misdemeanor.
They offered a misdemeanor.
Right. They offered a plea to a misdemeanor in the first trial.
Originally with Mr. Chester, yes.
Okay, but how do we know she wouldn't have received 6 months from the judge at that time?
Because that wasn't the plea deal.
Was there a plea deal?
That was not the plea offer that was made when she had Mr. Chester as an attorney.
What was the plea offer?
It's not part of the record. My recollection is that it was the same, substantially similar. It was some sort of reduced, some sort of suspended sentence.
So you did not plead, and it's not part of this record, what sentence may or may not, under a preponderance standard, have been given with the misdemeanor assault plea, had the plea been accepted?
We pled that it was the same plea offer was my understanding.
You did not say that. That's not what it said. You said there was a recommendation or an offer to plead to a misdemeanor. That's what the plea did say, I believe.
Okay. There was an offer to plead to a misdemeanor then, as it's pled in the complaint with Mr. Chester, and he never
If we were to expand the present tort from where it presently is, which is unlawful convictions as opposed to sentencing differences, you've not pled that there would have been any difference in the first misdemeanor plea deal. You didn't say there's no way we'd have gotten 6 months in the misdemeanor plea deal. We would have gotten the exact 10 days suspended that we ultimately got after a writ has been issued by a trial court, which I can assure you is a very different context for a prosecutor to be negotiating pleas under. So how isn't that by itself? Doesn't that moot all these tough legal issues? You can't get to where you want to go because you've not pled a causal connection between what happened and what would have happened had your client been given the misdemeanor plea deal and been told about it and accepted it.
Respectfully, my position is that we have pled that causal connection, and two instances where we pled that causal connection, and I'll direct the court's attention to among other places, it's in paragraph 25 of the complaint, which is the bottom of page of Joint Exhibit 5. We go through the causal connection that has already been established by Judge Jay Sweat, who is the trial court judge who overheard the habeas corpus proceeding. Of course, this was vacated for ineffective assistance of counsel. And two of the three bases for the habeas corpus decision, the first of which was the failure to convey the initial plea offer that we're discussing. Chester's failure to convey the plea offer. Never told Ms. DeSetti about it, never explained to her, by the way, you're going to...
I think my question was, if you've got to answer my question, I think my question was really this. You're alleging that some of the damages are based on her being incarcerated for 6 months.
Yes.
But you've not pled anything to indicate that it was approximately caused by the defendant's malpractice or negligence that caused her to serve 6 months that she wouldn't have served otherwise. Paragraph 11 says she was offered a plea to a misdemeanor. Does not say she would have served 6 months.
It does not say that. No.
Does not say that.
Paragraph 25, however, says that, and it quotes, it says that that it had already been determined that there's a reasonable probability that but for the ineffective assistance, and this is dealing with the failure to convey the plea offer, the conviction and sentence under the offer's terms would have been less severe than under the actual judgment and sentence imposed.
What does that mean?
It means that it is reasonably probable that she would have suffered a lesser than a six-month sentence.
See, I think what it meant was she would have had a misdemeanor. And whether it had been less sentence or not, who knows?
The conviction and sentence under the offer's terms is what is pled.
Okay.
And
don't you think you have to have some indication that but for the malpractice, she would have served less than 6 months? And that's all you got is that paragraph from 25, that statement in 25.
We have a different statement in 25, which is the other assignment of ineffective assistance of counsel, the third of them, and that is, again, the habeas corpus court finds there's a reasonable probability that but for Chester's deficient performance, the results of the proceeding would have been less severe than the judgment and sentence imposed.
Well, that's all they had to do was to give you a new trial. I don't know if that's enough for you to go forward on this claim. Just because there's a reasonable probability is not enough to go forward on this claim where you have to show proximate cause, is it?
We're at the demur stage of the hearing,
right?
And of the trial. And the law on this is, the law on this is clear from Atkins. Atkins gives one general rule, post-conviction ruling adverse to a defendant prevents recovery, blanket rule. Gives a first consideration, so two considerations, which are case by case. Consideration one, whether or not the plaintiff has obtained post-conviction relief, that's not going to apply here either because she did successfully obtain post-conviction relief. Where we are is consideration number
but
two.
The post-conviction relief was not the inadequacy of the evidence or the fact that it wasn't a crime or that the evidence was insufficient and the direct appeal got it wrong. It wasn't any of those things. So there's no assertion of factual innocence. The assertion is legal, not guilty standing because of the ineffective assistance of counsel. So you can't meet that standard, can you? That she is actually, you're making a claim that she's actually innocent?
We can't argue, actual innocence is not the law of Virginia under my reading of the law. That's not the claim we're making. We don't agree that there is an actual innocence standard under Virginia law. There is Atkins and there is Taylor that directly address this issue. And so to answer your question, no, Your Honor, we're not claiming actual innocence. Practically speaking, she is innocent of felony assault of a law enforcement officer under operation of law because she has pled guilty to a lesser included offense. She can never be prosecuted that again, so the innocence still proven guilty veil is going to remain on her permanently just by operation of the law. But, we are under this inquiry, is not under that second consideration. Whether she has or hasn't obtained post-conviction relief, which is what was addressed in Taylor, we're under consideration number two from Atkins. Consideration number two, which is again the case-by-case consideration, is this court says, because Atkins' guilt, not his attorney's alleged malpractice, was the proximate cause of his convictions, he would be benefiting from a crime if we allowed him to proceed in the case. And again, this is a demur, so we're talking about operation of law, effectively, not a jury issue.
So even if you're right,
yes,
and actual innocence is not required, and I'm not saying that I agree with that, but let's say that you are, what you really have to show, don't you, is that the damage that you're claiming were proximately caused by the fact that she was convicted of a felony as opposed to the reduced charge of misdemeanor that she was convicted of. Those are the damages you're limited to, aren't they?
The
In other words, but for the felony conviction, she would not have lost her nursing license. She would have been able to work for at least part of that time, arguably whether totally the time after the 6 months and before she got a new trial.
Yes. That would be the non-pecuniary damage she suffered in this clause.
Okay, that was my first question. So that's what you're seeking, I guess. But you also are seeking for the 6 months that she served incarcerated. And we've been going around in circles about that.
So. Yes. Okay. We can't seek what you would consider as tort damages under McLaughlin, okay. Or under Smith v. McLaughlin now. That's understood.
With regard to the license issue, in paragraph 22, you do allege that the nursing license was suspended as a direct result of her felony conviction, but I don't see any allegation that it wouldn't have happened as a result of a misdemeanor conviction.
It doesn't allege that it wouldn't have happened as a misdemeanor conviction. We can't speculate as to whether it would or wouldn't happen at all.
Well, then you've just conceded causation, because but-for causation is essential to every single part of this case.
The causation here is, and so we're talking about malpractice has been part of Virginia law with three elements, which is essentially the same elements as negligence, duty breach, cause harm, since for over 100 years. And then in 1997 with Atkins, this court puts other limits on other pleading requirements for malpractice cases when they arise out of criminal representation, because a person can't benefit from their crimes. So it's in that view that we look at these cases, like Ms. Sassetti's case. And so the point we're making is, and it's assignment of error 1 and 3 address this directly, it is when you look at why it is that Mr. Atkins, in the case-by-case criteria, needed to allege innocence. Well, actually, he didn't need to allege innocence. His guilt was a material consideration, the court said. It's because the damages that are suffered due to or because of criminal conduct are potentially incarceration, or in this instance, incarceration and loss of civil rights, for instance, because of the felony. The damages caused by malpractice in this context are wrongful.
Counsel, the questions you've been getting is focusing on this. Tort law generally is duty breach damages, right?
Yes.
Duty, a lawyer is supposed to be a good lawyer. Okay,
yes.
Breach, the habeas court said that it was breached and probably was clearly breached. Causation and damages is, had that not happened, had 1 and 2 not happened, the stuff that happened to me would not have happened. And if you don't plead that but-for causation and prove it, there is no consummated tort. So you would have to say, look, I lost my nursing license because I had a felony. But under the rules of the Nursing Control Regulation Board, whatever it is, if you have a misdemeanor of assaulting a cop, they don't have a problem with that. They'll let you keep your license. And I can prove by preponderance that would have happened. Or you could say, you know, if I had taken that plea, the plea had a stipulated sentence, and the stipulated sentence was 10 days all suspended, and I ended up spending 6 months in jail. If we were to expand this tort beyond what it presently is to cover sentencing, like Judge Ellis seemed to suggest in the Jones case, you would have to prove that too. But that's what we're struggling with your case, is where have you pled? And how could you plead under the facts of this case causation, but for causation?
Again, it pleads and shows that a court has already determined that that but for, and that's the actual quote from the language from the habeas court, but for his deficient performance in two separate areas.
But I think you're misunderstanding something. What the habeas court was saying under Strickland is, but for the lawyer's screw-up, there wouldn't have been a felony conviction. Okay. The question you have is, but for the felony conviction, I would not have served 6 months. But for the felony conviction, I would not have lost my nursing license, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's what is pled in paragraph 25, where we're quoting the other court, is but for this, the sentence and the judgment and sentence imposed would have been less severe, which is the difference between. So the measure of damages in these cases, when I'm driving it with Atkins, and again, even if you look at Zisk and the cases bolstering Atkins, The measure of damages is the difference between, and also with the Link v. Jones case, the way that the federal court is interpreting Virginia case law, it is the difference between the warranted sentence that's imposed versus the unwarranted sentence that's imposed. This is a problem for Mr. Atkins, in his case, for instance, because he's serving life regardless. So necessarily, if the court, because we're talking about necessary, we're talking about whether something is necessarily precluded because we're at a demur stage in the hearing. So our point is that we pled with requisite sufficiency, certainly to apprise in notice pleading of what the facts are. And as far as causation, we pled that not only that it did probably cause her harm, the sentence was probably worse than it would have been otherwise, but we also showed that a court has already made that determination. So that's the basis for us asking for relief, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
May it please the court, my name is Sabrina Chester, and I'm here on behalf of Francis Chester and his law office, Chester Chestari Law. Your Honors, if I may, this case boils down to the concept that a guilty party should not be rewarded for his or her guilty acts. More specifically, that a petitioner or plaintiff in a legal malpractice action must plead post-conviction relief in order to show proximate causation, to show that her attorney's malpractice
was,
and not...
Well, she did plead post-conviction relief, didn't she? She got a different result.
No, she did, with the habeas corpus petition being granted. Her conviction was vacated, that's correct. But at that point, the prosecution decided to recharge her, this time with a reduced charge, misdemeanor assault, which is a lesser included offense of assault and battery on a law enforcement officer.
And according to the pleadings, that was offered ahead of time.
According to the pleadings, but we don't have the specifics in the pleadings,
right,
as to what that plea.
Right, but according to the pleadings, there was going to be a reduction to a misdemeanor anyhow.
But to the extent to it, we're not sure.
Okay.
So, since there was no, in this case, there's no causation, there's no linkage between showing that but for the attorney's malpractice, DeSetti had harm. In this case, DeSetti failed to allege that she obtained post-conviction relief in the sense that she was completely found innocent. Her charge was vacated.
Was the felony conviction appealed to the Court of Appeals?
Yes, it was.
On sufficiency grounds?
I'm not sure. I just know that she took the necessary steps to appeal and
did not receive. Was the petition denied or was it heard by a panel?
I'm not aware.
Okay, but the bottom line is whatever the Court of Appeals did, they affirmed either by denying the petition or on the merits.
That's correct.
Did it get appealed to this court as well?
I'm not aware of that either. All I know is that her final step was the habeas corpus petition, which was granted.
So her direct appeals, to the extent there were any, were all denied?
Were all denied. Correct.
So no court has declared her factually innocent of felony assault of a police officer?
That is correct. The charge was vacated, and it is our contention that at that point, if she was innocent and wanted to allege innocence again, it was at that point that she should have sought the opportunity to try her case again and to prove her innocence. Instead, she took the plea. It's a reduced...
And in fact, actually, your client brought out the fact that she committed this felony by having her testify that she assaulted the police officer during the trial, right?
According to the pleadings.
According to the pleadings,
taking,
yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. Okay.
The case precedent clearly establishes that a court is not going to permit or assist a guilty party to profit from his or her crime. The fact of the matter here is that she was found guilty. She pled guilty. That is acknowledging her guilt of the crime. The assault occurred. She's a guilty party. She cannot now reap consequences, or she cannot be rewarded for those guilty actions.
Let me ask you this question. There's certainly been a recent development, maybe not a recent development, but a trend, or it's happened more often than not, where we've looked at things that happened in plea bargaining and found that there was ineffective assistance and granted habeas petitions and had cases just like this one be remanded for a retrial. Is that putting a plaintiff or a defendant in the criminal case, a potential plaintiff in the legal malpractice case, making a tough decision. Do I fight? Do I accept this beneficial plea bargain, perhaps suspended jail a misdemeanor with no time, and waive my right to any potential claim against my attorney who committed malpractice according to the pleadings? Or do I roll the dice and hope that I do better in a trial and preserve my right to have a malpractice claim? What kind of a jury choice is that offering the defendant?
Well, that definitely is a consideration that the defendant is going to have to take. But any time a defendant is faced with a plea bargain, that's a decision that they have to weigh. They have to say, okay, if I'm truly innocent of this crime, am I going to plead guilty? Well, maybe I will because the sentence is going to be reduced. But if I do, then I can't go against my attorney for his malpractice. Excuse me.
But surely we don't want to incentivize plea bargaining one way or the other with rolling the dice with a claim for damages later.
No, we don't. That's correct, Your Honor. But when you are faced with a plea bargain and you're in that position, there, I contend that there's more on the line than just, you know, a potential malpractice claim. It's your innocence. And if you're innocent, it's your right to prove your innocence. And that's the choice you're going to make.
Well, what if you're guilty of a misdemeanor but not a felony?
That's...
Why could the person plead that they were actually innocent in their malpractice case and then prove by preponderance of the evidence they were not guilty of the felony?
Could you repeat the first part? I'm sorry.
Scenario that we're discussing right now is an instance in which the defendant pleads guilty to a misdemeanor mm-hmm. instead of the felony they were originally convicted of. In their malpractice case, if they allege that they were actually innocent of the crime they were found guilty of, in proving their case, why couldn't they put on evidence to show they did not commit the felony they were found guilty of?
Well, I guess my understanding would be that it would be barred.
Why would that be barred?
Well, isn't it established on the record, on the court has already determined through the plea bargain that individual is guilty?
Of the misdemeanor.
Of the misdemeanor.
Right.
So, if I understand your question...
It was supposed to be a friendly question.
Okay. But,
and I was trying to get you out of the hole you were in.
Oh,
okay. But, and what I was saying is, why couldn't... They were worried... The scenario that we were dealing with was the fact that a person has this terrible dilemma
right.
when they are retried as to whether or not they plead guilty to the misdemeanor, because if they do, they're waiving their right to bring their malpractice action against their lawyer.
I understand.
But if they claim that the lawyer committed malpractice by having them be found guilty of a felony, mm-hmm. then I don't see why pleading guilty to the misdemeanor would necessarily bar that. So don't worry about it.
Okay.
Move on to the next
thing. Now, the one thing I want to bring out is that in this case, there are some hard facts that are facing the court. And if you look at the facts as alleged in the pleadings, your heart may go out and you may feel for DeSetti. It's a hard case, but you don't want to let hard facts make for bad law.
It's not that hard. She assaulted a police officer and pled guilty to felony assault, and she was found guilty of misdemeanor assault later after habeas. I don't know where the sympathies really lie here.
Well, I'm happy to hear you say that. Now, the studies discussed...
I'll give you the other side if you want to hear it. I understand the idea about not rewarding a person who commits a crime. What about absolving an attorney who commits malpractice and causes damages from being required to compensate the plaintiff for those damages?
That's,
how do we balance that?
That is a valid point. I believe that an attorney's rise and fall and their success is based on reputation. And if they are found as ineffective assistance of counsel by a court on a habeas corpus petition, there's punishment in that. Their caseload's going to drop and they're not going to be a successful attorney at that point. So I believe that there are consequences in other ways that the court necessarily doesn't have to itself put on.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. That's a good answer. I appreciate that. But let me ask you a hypothetical. It's somewhat related to this case. Let's say in this case she was found guilty of the felony.
Okay.
Lost her nursing license for because of the felony, which she would not have lost for the misdemeanor, then there would be the but for the malpractice that caused her to get convicted of a felony as opposed to the misdemeanor that was offered her. She'd been damaged. Should she be compensated for that damage?
I would just stand with the fact that she's a guilty party. There's no... It's a hard line.
That's certainly one position to take. I understand that.
It's been established with case precedent. Some exceptions were trying to be raised. Jones v. Link, that's a different case. Of course, it's a federal case. But in that case, it's a sentencing error. And then we have the case of Taylor v. Davis. But in that case, Taylor, the charge that he was charged with and found guilty, wasn't even a crime at the time. So therefore, he truly was innocent. And I believe that the actual innocence standard and requirement is necessary in cases for malpractice of a criminal.
Have we ever had a case that didn't impose the actual innocence requirement?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Now, in this case, again, if DeSetti hadn't taken the plea, and if she had gone to trial and she was found innocent, we would be faced with different facts. But those aren't the facts that we're faced with here today. She did plead guilty. She's a guilty party. And because she pled guilty, and she's now precluded, she's barred from seeking recourse through malpractice action. So, Your Honors, I'll conclude just by stating that under established case precedent, and the court will not permit or assist a guilty party to profit from his or her crime. And if a party is guilty to the underlying crime, which in this case, assault, simple assault, is the same as a lesser included offense of assault and battery on a law enforcement officer, you cannot file for legal malpractice because she cannot show proximate causation, which is a requisite to legal malpractice. Therefore, we state that the court below was correct in upholding and granting Chester's demur, because to said he was a guilty party, she did not and cannot plead that she was innocent of the underlying crime and that she obtained any post-conviction relief. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Your time has expired, and the court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All right.